opportunity to be up here June, July, and August full time. And during that time, I got to over 60 meetings, including just about a dozen of the Friday night speaker meetings, and I enjoyed every one. And I want to thank you, Chance, for including me as a speaker. This is a wonderful opportunity for all of us to get together and hear a fuller version of the story of both, you know, the pain we all suffered and then the recovery that some of us have been gifted to be able to go through. So I'll speak about, you know, what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a story that's very personal to me. It was a life-changing decision to stop drinking. A life-changing decision to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can honestly sit here tonight, you know, some 5 years after I stopped drinking, and tell you that I'm genuinely happy that I'm an alcoholic. And because alcoholism wasn't the cause of the problems. It was really just the multiplier, okay, of a life that I was living that was going to kill me anyway. And as I tell my story, I think you'll understand a little bit about where I was headed before. Alcohol nearly took my life. And then alcohol sound just gave me a brand new life, a better life. So, you know, my sobriety date is November 14th, 2015. So it gives me, at this point, about 5 years and 3 months of recovery. So I'd like to start the story by simply walking back in time to November 14th, 2015. So you understand how it all began. And the story that preceded it, and my story of recovery, make a lot more sense. But November 14th, 2013, I was at my house in Orlando, Florida. And I've been in Orlando for about 20 years. And I've been a drinker since a few days after I turned 18. But there was a lot that had changed over the years with regard to my drinking. And that day, November 14th, 2013, began like so many of the days over the past year before that. I woke as late as I possibly could. And I woke as late as I possibly could because I knew the day was going to be hell. The day was going to involve nothing. Because that's how every day for the previous 12 months had been. And I remember that morning very clearly, to this day. And I hated to get out of bed. I just hated it. Because I knew the hell that was ahead of me. The day of nothing. And I began the morning by getting out of bed and going straight to the medicine cabinet because my alcoholism was so severe at that point that I couldn't eat or drink anything. I would vomit immediately. The amount of alcohol I consumed in the past year was that bad. But as a good alcoholic, 6 weeks before that day, I'd gone to the doctor for the last time and I asked him for something solve my problem with projectile vomiting. And he gave me the same pills they give chemotherapy patients. The same pills. I found that if I took that first thing upon arising, gave it about 20 minutes to work, that first vodka and tonic would stay down. And that was critical. I had to drink. The withdrawal symptoms were terrible. I would awake in the morning just shaking. My face was bright red. That morning, I weighed 42 pounds more than I weighed today. I couldn't fit into any of my clothes. My blood pressure was sky high. But mostly, I had nothing left to live for. I had been drinking around the clock for 12 straight months. I couldn't leave the house. I was too weak. I could barely get out of bed and make it to the bar. That's how bad my addiction was. And that day began with that pill. And it began 20 minutes later with that first drink, and then the second drink, and then the third drink. And I had that big bottle of vodka sitting there, and I knew my goal before I passed out late that night was to drink that whole bottle, because that's what I'd done every day. And I had no hope. I could barely function as a human being. I had long since stopped answering my cell phone, because I'd learned that if I answered the phone, I couldn't remember even a few minutes later what I'd said or what I'd talked. And I was almost too weak to walk. It was a big effort to go from my bed that day to the bar and started my drinking. But that day I did begin drinking and stayed down. And then something happened on November 14th, 2013 that was different than all of the days that preceded it. That was at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, that bottle of vodka half finished. It was a moment of clarity in my life. I realized at that moment that I was going to die. This disease was about to kill me. There was no way a human being could consume what I had consumed or consider living. And for some reason, which I now attribute to God, I had that moment of clarity. I didn't have it the day before, and I was just sick. But that day, November 14th, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I realized I was going to die. And here's the amount of strength I had left us on that day. I was sitting on the sofa in my TV. The telephone was 25 feet away. But I didn't have the strength to get off the sofa. I was too young and too weak. So with the last ounce of energy I did have, I rolled off the sofa, got on my hands and knees, crawled across the kitchen floor, pulled myself up and bowed down. When the operator answered, I said, "I think I'm going to die. Not even evidence." And a few minutes later, they crashed in the river. I was out in that ambulance on the way to the intensive care unit at the local Dr. Phillips Hospital down there in Orlando. And all I remember about that trip was how happy I was that they had arrived. And I knew I was going to die. What's interesting about that day, November 14th, 2013, is that is the day of my last drink. I have not had a drop of alcohol since then. So, if you hold the thought about how that last day of drinking was, let me tell you how my life began. Because there isn't anything in my family background that would have indicated that I was about to become an alcoholic. So I was born in San Francisco, downtown, and I was born to a relatively poor family. My dad worked for the post office, my mom was a secretary. They'd been married just a couple of years before I was born. And all I can remember during my childhood, both in San Francisco and then later in Southern California, and then finally in Washington, D.C., is I never saw my parents drink. I never saw my mom and my dad ever pick up a drink. Now, our relatives, they came from a big, large Catholic family. Well, there was plenty of drinking at family events. But my recollection of living at home was my mom didn't drink, my dad didn't drink. And they hosted parties. We had coffee, we had tea, we had soda. But we didn't have alcohol. And my parents loved me. There was no doubt that they loved me. I was the firstborn. I was late in life for them. They didn't expect to have a child. My dad was 42 when I was born. But they treated me like a gift from God. I was a gift to them. They were very Catholic. They were very tied and happy with their religion. And so one of the first things they did, which later on became one of my first resentments, was they put me in Catholic school. So I'd grown up on the streets of L.A., playing ball with my friends, playing in the cul-de-sac, skating, skateboarding, doing all those things. But all of a sudden, in first grade, I found myself dressed kind of funny. You know, black pants, white shirt, bow tie. And none of my friends looked like that when they went to school. And I had to pass by their bus stop on the way to my bus stop. And you know, my parents told me what a wonderful gift it was that they'd give me, because they didn't have enough money. Paying for private education was something special. But over the years that I attended Catholic school, which happened to be 12, went all the way through high school, I never saw it as a gift. I saw it as kind of a black label. I was like, why is that I can't be with all my friends? Why do I have to dress different? Why do I have to do different things? I was a top student. There was no doubt that I was well educated by the school system. And I'll refer to this a little bit later when I talk about my recovery and my understanding of the difference between spirituality and religion. But I had 12 years of straight A's in religion. And since I hadn't had a drink when I exited high school, based on my family situation and my education, to me, alcohol was an unknown. And my first drink didn't occur until 3 days after I got to college. So I remember my dad taking me down to the College of William and Mary in Virginia from our home in Washington, D.C., getting me all settled in. And the story of my first drink, though, if I can share that with you, it's the story of why I was an alcoholic and the day I had that first drink. So I was sitting in my dorm room a couple of days after I checked in. It was lonely. I only knew a few people on campus. And we had a few days before class started, and a group of guys from my dorm from the floor came down, and they were going door to door, and they came to my door, which was open, and they said, "Hey, buddy, See, a bunch of us are going down to the college pub, and we're going to have beer. We'd like you to join us. And being kind of scared and away from home and not knowing anybody, you know, I thought to myself, wow, this is great. I get to meet some guys. And so there we go across campus. There's four or five of us, and we hit this place called the College Pub. And so we sit down, and I said, I don't drink. I said, well, how does this work? And they said, well, we order pitchers of beer. I thought, aha, pitchers of beer. So I ordered my pitcher, they ordered theirs. And about 3 hours later, I had downed that whole pitcher of beer. And that buzz, that first buzz, you know, any spiritual experience I'd ever had in campus. You know what I'm talking about. That wasn't, as it turns out, as an alcoholic, you know, they were just having a normal good time with beer. I was having a spiritual transformation. Now, I didn't know that I was having that. I didn't know I was falling in love with something that tried to kill me. But in fact, that's exactly what was happening, because I'm an alcoholic. So I'll never forget that walk back from the college pub, because I got introduced to everything I was going to live with for the next almost 4 years. You know, first of all, there was a single sidewalk that went from my dormitory to the pub. When we got there, on the way back, there were two. And I remember laughing riotously as I stumbled from one to the other, picked myself up. Okay. And finally, somehow, miraculously, get back to the dorm. So I got up to my room. I said goodbye to my new friends. I sat down on my bed, and you all know what came next, right? Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, I was sitting down, but the room was spinning. And it was spinning really fast. And I'm not subject normally to motion sickness, but that one, the room spinning did it for me. So the next thing I know, I'm across the hall, I'm in the bathtub, I'm hugging that toilet like my life depended on it. And after a couple of hours of just sheer pain, I passed out. It's like the first night of my drinking on the floor of the bathroom on the cold towel. Next morning I woke up, man, somebody put a knife through my head and stuck something through my stomach, and I remember thinking to myself, man, that was really painful. Really painful. Well, this really sucks. I'm sick of pain and all that stuff. So you want to guess what happened the next time they came by my door? You all know the story. You've been there, I'm sure, yourselves. You know, they came by a couple days later, and they said, hey, George, go back to the pub. Would you like to join us? And I thought to myself, that was a small price to pay for all that fun. And I was in. So my career in drinking, by the time I exited my freshman year of college, I was a daily drinker. Okay? And I thought that was a normal way of living, because the people I hung out with were just like me. And I remember going home for that first summer break. And here's an interesting story, though, that tells you something about how much my parents loved me. So I pack up the car, I get back from William & Mary after that first year. Then, you know, my dad greets me for going to Saturday. And I'm kind of thinking in the back of my mind, how is this drinking thing going to go all summer, right? I come from a non-alcoholic family. So my dad helps me in with the stuff, takes me to the kitchen, sits me down and says, how would you like a beer? I'm like, my God, you know, the man offered me a beer. That's not possible. So we had a beer, we enjoyed that, and we had another beer. And I couldn't help myself. I said, Dad, I said, you know, I went off to college, I came back to you. I said, you know, I lived here for 18 years, I wish I'd drink a beer. True story. He said, well, he said, I used to drink a lot of beer before I came up. I said, but when you were born, she came to me. And she said, would you consider not drinking in front of George until he heads off to college? Set an example. And my father loved me that much. Mm-hmm. He put down his beer to give me a better start to my life. Now, I never knew that that's what he'd done until I asked him before. But by this time, I'm addicted. By this time, beer is a daily part of my daily routine. So I met a woman in college, and she was a sorority president, and seemed to be the person I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. So went to graduate school, got out, got married. And that marriage produced two wonderful daughters. I'll tell you a little bit about the story of those daughters, because it's an important part of what this program gave me back. They gave me back my daughters later. But about 10 years into the marriage, I got promoted for the third time at AT&T. And the part of alcoholism I didn't understand until I got into the rooms is that the disease isn't about drinking. It's about the choices we make with our lives. The selfish, self-centered choices. And after 10 years of marriage and 2 wonderful kids, I had a career that looked pretty promising. But I had a burden to bear, and that was I had a family, kids, and home duties, and I saw that as a trade-off. And so I did some things that 10th year of marriage to end up losing the marriage, ending the marriage, in order to pursue my business career. So what had arrived in my life wasn't alcohol at this time. I was 35 years old. What had arrived in my life was my number one character defect. That was grief. Grief had arrived. And grief is now going to consume most of the next 15 to 20 years of my life. It had me just as badly as alcohol eventually would have. So that marriage ended, and a second marriage began a few years later. And what I chose to do for the second marriage was A, find somebody who could drink like me, and B, make sure that my career would be my career. If I say we're going to Seattle, we're going to Seattle. If I say we're coming to Orlando, we're coming to Orlando. If I say I need to be gone on a business trip for 2 weeks, okay. So even my second marriage was a choice of me. It was a choice of ego, a choice of my career. And as I began to travel, my career did take off. But what slowly but surely faded into the background was my relationship with my 2 daughters. And suddenly I was many miles away. Suddenly I was too busy to remember birthdays, too busy to do something for Christmas. If there was a special event, like a prom, I was too busy to make it. And so slowly but surely, okay, I began to act as if I had no daughters. And that particular behavior went on from about the age of 10 for my daughters all the way to their mid-20s. Again, that wasn't because of alcohol. It was because of ego and greed. That was consuming. That was becoming the sole purpose. That was becoming my higher power. And I came to believe what the world had taught me since I was in business school, and that is that money buys happiness. Okay, every single ad I'd ever seen or ever seen, you know, if you buy this particular car, you'll be happy. If you get this particular purse, you'll be happy. If you get a bigger house, you'll be happy. How about a boat? You'll be happy. And I believe what the world had taught me. Because I had given up any interest in God when I got to college. I became mostly interested in me. I became, so to speak, the center of my own universe. And life had gone well. I had accomplished a lot. I was relatively healthy. I was relatively successful. Financially, for sure. I didn't have any bad relationships. But slowly but surely, I began to not have any good relationships anymore. So what transpired from about the age of 40 to right before I came into this program 5 years ago is I began to isolate from my people that loved me the most. And I spent all of my time working, playing, making money, basically feeling like I was the guy in charge. But what also progressed is my alcoholism. And particularly in those last 4 or 5 years before I found this program, I had gone from beer to wine, wine to vodka, and then vodka in huge quantities. The last year, there were 4 significant events that I want to share with you about my last year of drinking. And I think what was happening is God was taking pity on me finally. He was seeing the life that I was with, the selfishness that I was showing. Sense that I could buy happiness. And he decided to give me 4 messages that last year that finally led me to that date on November 14th, 2013. And the first one was the death of my mother at the age of 92. Now, this is a woman who had for decades suggested to me that the life I was living, that the priorities I had, were not the right priorities in life. She would all say to me, quit your job, drive a bus, or go back to church. I used to laugh. I said, Mom. So I told her, I said, Mom, it's people like you building and making things that provide a life like yours anytime. I actually said that to my mom. But as you will find out a little bit later as I talk about my recovery, she was right. She She saw it crystal clear. I just didn't believe it. So she passed away at the age of 92. It just so happened, the date of her death was 6 years ago, February 1st. Today. So 6 years ago, in the midst of my severe last year of drinking, I got that call from California and my mom died. And I was already drinking, so I just hopped on an airplane, flew to California, drank my way through the funeral, drank my way through the wake and the burial and the receptions. Now, I remember my sister who carried the load for me out there. She said, "Mom, I'd like to say something at Mom's memorial service." And I just sat there so drunk and I said, "I can't." I said, "You speak. I can't." And she knew why. But that sent a message to you, okay? That sent a message to you. I've now lost the woman who had supported me and coached me and loved me through all of the things that I'd ever done, including the drinking. And a few months later, I had an opportunity, because I was back home by this time drinking around the clock at home, to wake up one afternoon, I can't remember, it was about Wednesday afternoon, and I found a very strange thing in my bedroom. One of the strangest things that I've ever found in my bedroom, and that was in Orange County Sheriff's Office. As I roused from my pass-out state, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and sat up in bed and saw this fully clothed, well-armed sheriff in my bed, and I thought, this is not normal. It's not normal. So after a brief introduction, he announced to me that I had been Baker Acted by my wife at the time. Baker Acted in Florida was an involuntary incarceration into a psychiatric center. You get 72 hours of psychiatric evaluation, but you don't have a choice. So he explained to me I had two ways to leave there. Both of them were with him. One was voluntarily, in terms of the form of the sign, and the other was involuntarily in handcuffs. So even as drunk as I was, and as sick as I was, I thought to myself, voluntary approach sounded a bit nicer. But they ended up keeping me for 6 days, not three, because I was in that bad a condition. But that wasn't enough to cause me to stop drinking. It just wasn't. Okay, I called an alcoholic jail. Okay, they had locked doors. They had barbed wire fences. You had to get up at a certain time, go to sleep at a certain time, eat at a certain time, take their medications. And I wasn't willing yet to stop drinking. I'm willing to admit the end was near. But it was a warning sign. Okay, I was in the insane asylum, so to speak. Your successful 58-year-old businessman was locked up against his will. But I think the one that kind of put me over the edge, guys, I think they probably appreciate this, is 3 months later, it was July, and I was still drinking around the clock, and I got a call from my younger daughter. It was the same daughter I'd been ignoring for the better part of 15 years. So I'd been to her college graduation. I knew she was dating a guy. I met him. And knew she was living in Washington, D.C. But beyond that, I had not paid any attention to her until the day that I called. That call was something like this. She called me up and she said, "Dan, this is Karen, my fiancé, Brian, on the other line." And she said, "Dad, this is you're the last person that we're calling." Like, well, yeah. You have to understand that we thought long and hard about whether to invite you. And we decided to do so. But if you come, you'll not be a part of the wedding party. We have a separate table. And your name will not be mentioned. And you have to promise to not speak about us. Or to embarrass us in any way. Or some of my fiance's friends will escort you. But if those conditions are acceptable to you, you can come to my wedding. It was exactly 60 days after the wedding that I stopped drinking. And I can't say that it was my daughter's phone call, but penetrated all of that alcoholism and all that ego and greed, but I can honestly tell you it was a big part of it. That's not a call that a father ever wants to make. Not sure that way to invite you to the wedding. So, I've already relayed to you what happened on November 14th, 2018. I That's the day that I picked up the phone, dialed 911, asked for help, something I was not used to having to do, and got it. So I spent 4 days in intensive care. And I had a wonderful doctor who attended to me. There were two moments during those 4 days of intensive care that I still to this day remember. They're in large part the reason I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first one was after 48 hours in intensive care, with IVs in both hands, morphine drips, you know, all the liquids and vitamins that I had lost him. He comes into the ER room late at night and says, Mr. Holly, I have some good news. Looks like you're going to make it. But we weren't sure. Now, I remember the feeling that caused me to dial 911. I'm about to die. This is a man with a medical degree and many years of practice telling me I was that person. And then, on the fourth day, I was healthy enough for them to discharge me. And that same doctor came in second day. And he gave me three things to walk away with, the third one of which is the reason I'm here tonight. And that is, he said, here are the prescription medicines that I need you to take for the next 30 days. You've been through so much, and you've drank so much, there's a chance you might have a seizure, a heart attack, anxiety attack, anything like that. Here are the medications you need to take. The second thing is the diet. Eating anything worthy of eating for a year. So the dietitian had prepared one and made sure that I knew that was a way to get back. And the third thing he told me, was, if I were you, Mr. Holland, he says, I would go and seek out Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, if you ever drink again, you will surely die. Now, I doubt the medical school that they taught him to say that. But because I had nothing else to go through, no other way to solve this problem, because he was a doctor who saved my life, I went ahead and did just that. It took about 10 days to get my health back, be able to drive my car. Turns out the local Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is just 9/10 of a mile away. Literally across the street, a church I'd passed 1,000 times driving back and forth to the liquor store. And so I began my recovery with a group called the Dr. Phillips Group there in Orange County, outside of, very close to Orlando and University. It's a wonderful group. It's got about 140 members, fairly good size. And when I got to the first meeting, I knew I was in the right place. I'm not sure if any of you have felt that at your first meeting, but I went early to that meeting. I wanted to be there a half hour early because, in my mind, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting would be 6, 8, 10 old white guys, right? Well past their prime. Because, you know, I had this image of what an alcoholic would be. So I wanted to get there early. I wanted to meet the head drunk. I wanted to have a chance to introduce myself as, you know, a sales and marketing guy. It's important. And so I did get there a half hour early. And I did meet the chairperson right off the bat, a guy named Hank. I mentioned his name because a few months later he became my sponsor. Then I did the single worst thing an alcoholic can ever do at their first meeting. It was, turned out, a big meeting. It was a beginner's meeting on a Sunday, and we had 65 people. When I got there, the place was empty, so I took the seat right next to the chairperson. Not knowing that that was going to be the center of attention for the next 60 minutes, as I saw it, as I recall it. But we had an interesting way of doing those beginner meetings on Sunday. We still do it down there, and that is, you go around the room, whether it's 40 people, 50 people, 60 people, it doesn't matter. It's beginner's meeting. Everybody announces their sobriety. And the person with 2 days, or 3 days, or less than 30 days, and the person with 40 years. And sitting next to the chairperson, he was kind. He started on the other side. And I got to listen to about 65 people say, keep the name. And for the first time in my entire life, I got to say those magic words. My name is George. I'm an alcoholic. What that meeting created for me was a sense of accountability. I had just told 65 strangers that I had a disease. And what was interesting is I wasn't judged. There was no entrance exam. I didn't have to pass a test or pay a fee. I was just welcomed with open arms. And I told the story some number of months later to the people. I said, you know, after my first meeting, it was almost as if you had said to me at that first meeting, we were waiting for you. You know, we had your seat reserved. Okay? And it wasn't anything anybody said, it was the feeling that I had about being in the right place. And my story of recovery is in large part about finding a home group, going to meetings, and getting a sponsor. And, you know, I love chips. I love that first chip. I love the 30 day, the 60 day, the 90 day. When I arrived at 120 days, I found out my home group didn't have a chip. And I was bummed, but I thought, what a perfect day for me to ask somebody to be my sponsor. And the sponsor I picked is the whole reason I'm here today, in the condition I'm in. Because he was a retired beat cop in New York City, barely a high school education. And I was a wildly successful business guy, MBA in finance. And that was what made it work. Because what he had was what I wanted. He had humility. He had spirituality, he had kindness, he had firmness. All the qualities I lacked. But after those first few months of seeing him in action, hearing his words and talking to him, I realized, when I grow up, so to speak, you know who I want to be? I want to be Hank. I want to be the retired beat cop with 30 years of sobriety. That's the guy that I want to turn into. So I asked him in just that way. He said, "Did you teach me everything you've learned?" He said, "I sure did." And I had a wife at the time. No kids at home. Everybody's off, graduated from college. And what's important about my recovery is that my wife was also an alcoholic. Okay. Now, I was a big alcoholic. She was a little alcoholic. But nonetheless, she was. And as I got sober, and the months started to tick off, one, two, three, four, something noticeable to me happened at home, and that is she kept drinking. And she got very angry. Now, that's the same woman who sent me to the psychiatric ward under the Baker Act. And I was waiting for that wonderful, thank God you stopped drinking, I got you back. And I didn't get anything like it. Not at all. In fact, I began to think that if she woke up in the morning, she was angry just because she woke up. And but I was working my program. I was starting the steps. I had a sponsor. I was going to 4, 5, 6 meetings a week. And then God did for me something that I could not have done for myself. I'm going to share it because it's important. So I had exactly 5 months, 2 days out of prayer. And I knew the situation at home was not good. In fact, it was opposite of good. It was pushing me on my surrender. It was challenging me in every way. I'm really sober and challenged. So that particular evening, after the April 16th, 5 months and 2 days, my alcoholic wife went to bed early. And I went ahead and went out on the back porch about 10 o'clock at night to do some reading and some meditation. That's the way I was finishing my evenings at that time. And about an hour later, okay, I was out on the back porch quietly doing my thing, and she came out in what turned out to be a blackout drunk. She'd been drinking all day long. I didn't know. I was worried. Okay. She hadn't gone to bed early. She blacked out. And when she awoke, I guess, in her blackout, she decided that there was a need to attack me. And that is precisely what she went out on back when she did. Never saw it coming. Never heard a word. Until someone got hit. When I get hit back, I split right up out of it. Blinded me in the right eye. Okay. As soon as I realized I'd been attacked, I reached up and there was blood all over my hands, and I looked up and there she was standing. I didn't know what she hit me with. But I did know I was hurt. So interestingly enough, I had another reason to call 911. I needed an ambulance again. And in the course of the conversation, the operator said, "What do you need?" I said, "I'm an ambulance, I'm bleeding badly." They said, "Why are you bleeding badly?" I said, "My wife just attacked me." A few minutes later, an ambulance showed up. The ambulance took me to the hospital. The police officer had heard me. She was charged with 2 felonies. And I came back from the hospital about 2 a.m. in the morning. I mopped up the blood with that porch. What I did for the next couple of hours, I said this surrendered prayer over and over and over again. least the words of that prayer were sent through. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And what had just transpired that night, I couldn't change. My 18-year marriage had ended in a bloody mess on the bathroom. And I was just approaching my 60th birthday. I can assure you, in my program for recovery, I never expected to be 60th single. But what actually happened is she was removed from the house, charged with felonies, and there was a 10-month no-contact rule put in place. And that hell that I had been through in those months prior, in those first 5 months of recovery, was lifted from me. There was nobody home. There was no distractions. There was no arguments. There were no fights. And we did end up getting divorced about 11 months later. But it actually turned out to be a gift that I could not probably got on my own, a gift that God gave. Now, my eyesight came back, but what really came back was an opportunity to pursue this program 7 days a week the way I wanted to pursue it. And I got a couple things that I'll share with you have been critical to my recovery. The absence of the person who was torturing me in the early part of my recovery turned out to be a blessing. It opened up an incredible new life for me. I didn't see it that way after it happened. Okay. I just saw, a stitched eye and an end in marriage. So I went to my sponsor a few days later and I said, "What the hell is wrong with this program? What the hell is wrong with this program? I think there's these things called the promises, and I'm not seeing them in my life." But he told me to read the acceptance paragraph. Most of you have been around even a little while, read that paragraph, page 417 of the Big Book. And it basically says, well, I'm disturbed, right? Because something, somebody, some situation in my life is unacceptable to me. Then the line that I've used on a daily basis, since he pointed this at me way back when, was nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. And that thought caught my attention. If I have faith, and I was beginning that reconnection with my higher power. If I have faith, and I have faith that nothing in his plan's a mistake, and this situation I just went through isn't a mistake. Okay? There's something in it for me. I just don't know what it is. So, if I had to say there were two things that I've learned in AA that are really critical, one is that not drinking is a great way of life. The second is the spiritual mind that absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And all of a sudden I began to view my life, both my past life as I worked the steps, and the life that I was now living as a sober man, as never having an actual mistake. There were bad decisions. There were people I harmed. There were amends to be made. Okay? But none of them, at the end of the day, including my own alcoholism, none of them were a mistake. They were a test, a way of strengthening myself, a way of growing, a way of facing life and succeeding, even living, to get me to a point where suddenly I'd be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the greatest organization I've ever been. That acceptance paragraph is powerful. That line, nothing happens in God's world by mistake, was particularly important. Mending relationships. When people ask me what it's like in Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly my friends who are out there, I said it is the greatest program for mending relationships that I've ever seen, better than any book I've ever read, any counselor I've ever talked to. And I had an opportunity to mend my relationship with my two daughters. I wasn't guilty of physical abuse or financial abuse. I was guilty of emotional abuse. I basically left their lives when I was 15 years, at a time when they should have had a father. So my younger daughter, I went up to travel to see her about 6 months after I stopped there. And I just told her what had happened. And I told her, I said, I don't know if I'm entitled to a second chance, but if I am, I'll make the most of it. And having nearly not invited me to a wedding, it seemed that something was different. She welcomed me back. Now, since that time, my younger daughter's had two grandchildren. So I've got a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old grandchild. And I told her more than once, the good news is, those children will never see you drunk like you do. That's my promise. The second story of mending relationships, though, is an important one. I want to share it. And I share it in my home group anytime we talk about step 4. Step 4 is the step that made me fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in order to do step 4, I had to do a fearless and searching moral inventory. And so when I did my sheet, I put the names up there that I obviously needed to make amends to. And one of them was my older daughter, Stephanie. Now, Stephanie is in San Francisco. I was in Orlando. But I couldn't complete step 4. I couldn't talk about the damage I had done to my oldest daughter unless I asked her what that damage was. So I began the process of calling her and texting her and emailing her every single week. And I got no reply. But I got no answer. And that went on for 7 weeks. The call went unanswered. The voicemail not returned. The text message not acknowledged. The email unresponded. And over that period of time, I thought, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? And on the 7th weekend, I made the call that I made on the other 6. And the phone answered, and it was her. And I said, oh, Stephanie, I said, I've been trying to reach you, and I just need to talk to you. I have so much to share with you. And she said, would you like to come visit? And I said, of course, I'll be there for meeting with you. And I had to get out there to find out the damage I had done to my oldest daughter. She was nearly 30. And 2 days later, I was on a flight. And I rehearsed over and over again for 5 hours. How was I going to open? What was I going to say? What could a father who neglected his own daughter for 15 years? What could he say? How bad was the pain that she wouldn't reply? She wouldn't answer. She wouldn't acknowledge. Until she realized I wasn't going to stop. So I landed in San Francisco, hopped in a rental car, drove to her townhouse north of San Francisco, knocked on the door, took a couple of deep breaths, and speak to her. She opened the door. She welcomed me in, sat me down. Before I could say a word, Stephanie looked at me and she says, Dad, I'm so sorry that I didn't reply to all your messages, didn't answer your calls, didn't acknowledge your texts. But she said, there's something very important that I needed to tell you face to face. And she said, Dad, I'm an alcoholic. I've been in recovery. Passion. And she said, but I know from the work I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was not the best daughter that I could have been to you. That week was a special week. Because, my friends, I thought that that trip was my step through. I'm certain it was my step through. Turns out God had a different plan. That visit to San Francisco was her ninth step amends for her father. And she wanted to do it face to face. So after a week, we hugged at the airport, and I went home, and she said, Dad, she said, I've been through a lot. Recovery, rehab center, a family that didn't understand my disease, she says, but I now have somebody in my life who understands me. So, she now has 4 or 5 years of sobriety. She's on a speaker tour out there. She sponsors other women. And I have a new relationship with my oldest daughter, one that I never would have expected had not been for Alcoholics Anonymous. So we are now at the end of our time. So I'd like to just thank Chance again for the opportunity to speak with you. I just want to talk about how much Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. It's given me back the family I should never have gotten back. It's given me back my health. But most importantly, it's given me God. But I didn't have God for religions. I had money. But I now realize what's important. And it is my God. So, thank you for the opportunity.
Awesome.